It's Icon Art Radio time with Donna Colby, Alan Cobb, and Bill Teeple.
And the Peanut Gallery.
Yeah, here we are. Well, last week you asked me about my show, the large work show, to complement Stacy Herlin's small work show up the street. And I don't think I explained in that show about the small work show, in case people don't know, but the small work show was begun by Art Life Society about six years ago, which is the organization, the nonprofit arts support organization created by Stacy Herlin, who was the founder of the Fairfield Art Walk. That's passed on to a large committee that runs it now. And so that gave her the opportunity to focus on her annual small work show. And over the years, it's become a Fairfield tradition. Everyone in Fairfield, all the artists in Fairfield usually make some contribution. But she's in her travels, she's connected with artists around the country, and she's invited artists from around the world. So she has some international artists, she has some artists from all over the United States, and a large group of artists that she shows still from Fairfield. So it's become a show that everyone knows about. And because everyone knows about it, it was fun for me to decide to do a show to complement that of large works. She has 355 works, and we have 9, possibly 10. I've been trying to figure out what to put on the balcony, and that might be the 10th painting if we can't put one of the others up there. But I had assembled 9 paintings by 8 artists. So
and these are I mentioned the artists.
They're all, 90 inches, 102 inches in one dimension. The smallest one, it looks like, will be 6 feet square, which is large for Fairfield. Most artists and most of the works we look at here in Fairfield are in that 3 to 4 foot range. And people think of those as large paintings compared to these little 12-inch square kind of type of thing that's in the small work show. But still, artists don't tend to work that large in Fairfield. Bob Horline has worked large. But in general, artists work in a smaller format. However, as you pointed out a moment ago, Donna, that is not large for the art world, the larger art world. We were talking about that to install the Richard Serra pieces in his retrospective of the Museum of Modern Art, they had to hoist them with a crane up to the second floor and through a, they sort of had to remove half the wall or something to get it in there.
Didn't they build a whole
They built
room.
The building.
Oh, they
yeah.
built the building around the...
With a special
yeah.
floor
yeah,
because it
the
weighed so
wall.
Many tons.
Oh, yeah,
it's pieces,
that's right.
So
that's
so many
right.
tons.
Exactly.
So in your case, in your gallery, with sheetrock walls and all, how do you mount a painting that's 9 feet long and keep it
well,
from falling down
the
during the show?
Find a strong stud.
Well, I'm going to find out. Each of these paintings has come to me in a different, with a different kind of installation mechanism on the back. Some of them seem to have wires, which means we've got to find a stud and put at least 2 good hooks into 2 studs and hang that painting on its wire. In general, we, with large paintings, we put blocks at the top and screw them right into the stud. And then we just lift the stretcher bar and lay it right on top of those blocks. They might have a little wedge effect to them that sort of holds the painting so it doesn't slip forward. However, we don't have earthquakes very often in Fairfield, so it's not as important as in California, where a large painting could get shaken off the wall.
Yes. Now, we were counting the artists that you mentioned last week, and I think we came up short by 1.
Well, I'll name them all again to see if we've got them. We have 8 artists from around the regions that I've scoped out, some of the top artists in the region. Susan Chrysler White of the University of Iowa, Laurel Farron of the University of Iowa, Julia Swadron, who's a visiting professor at the University of Iowa from Brooklyn, New York. We have Thomas C. Jackson of Cedar Rapids, Stephen Erickson of Iowa City, Matthew Kluber of Cedar Rapids, and Robert Horline is our one Fairfield offering this time, who is working on a large piece for this show. That is seven, I believe. And yes, that leaves the eighth that we didn't mention last time, which is the painting around which I built the show. You asked, did I make the show as a response to the Small Work show? And I didn't. I have been planning to do large paintings in there since the gallery was first remodeled. And the painting that I was going to build that show around was the one large painting that I had in town by Lucas Block of California. And I've showed his work before. We have a collector in town that has quite a few paintings, well, a large collection of artwork from a mix of pieces from around the globe. But a large selection of pieces by Lucas Block of Carmel, that region, Pacific Grove somewhere. He's out in that area of California. And she has works by Andrea Vicini, quite a collection of pieces.
Oh, right, I remember those pieces.
But we've shown all of those pieces except this one large painting, which was too large to get up into the old gallery. And it's been in storage, and I've been wanting to show it for some time. It's his work is hard edge abstraction, color fields, color hard edge planes, with an optical element involved. That is, there's somewhere between hard edge abstraction and op art. In other words, you stand back a ways and look at this painting, and it starts to do wonderful and interesting things with your retina and the things that happen with your retina in regard to after image and all that kind of thing, which I've always found quite enjoyable to experience. So that's the painting we built the show around, and it will be in the show for you to see.
So when you chose the pieces for this show, did you visit each artist and look in their studio and choose a specific work of theirs that would kind of, you know, like keeping in mind what all the other works were going to be, or did the artist choose the one that they wanted to show?
No, I chose, I visited studios and I looked at work and I chose a specific piece for this show. I was thinking size, and because some of these artists work in various dimensions. So I was thinking larger pieces by these artists. So I had to scope out people that were doing larger works. And then I selected one that was, first of all, my favorite large piece on its own. And then with the thought of how it would fit into the show. However, you never know until you assemble the pieces how they're all going to go together. And once again, now that I have most of these pieces in the gallery, it's always a surprise to see how they interplay with each other. And mm-hmm. So I'm still working that out.
It's like music, isn't it? It's like creating a chord, and so that the wholeness of what you see feels good to you.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and yet you want to be able to tune into each specific one. And
yeah, and so a museum person always wants more space, more space, more and more space. So that you can give more space to each work so that you can completely experience it and then turn and to look in another direction and your attention can fully go on to another piece. We don't have enough space for that, but I'll do the best I can. And because you'll see a couple of pieces sort of at the same time, even though one would be at something of a distance, I have to take into account how they harmonize together.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the new museums and the new wings on museums these days, the contemporary art museums, you'll find that they're getting bigger and bigger, and the rooms are getting huger and huger, and they're putting a single work on one huge wall. We love it. I mean, I wish I had that kind of budget in Fairfield and those kind of spaces to play with, because it's very nice. I just went maybe 6 months ago to the new wing of the Atlanta Art, the High Museum in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. A new wing by I can't remember which. They have a Richard Meyer, which is also the person that did one of the wings of the Des Moines Arts Center. They have a Richard Meyer section, but the new section there is by, what's his name? Somebody Piano or something. I can't remember, but a famous designer of museums. Mm-hmm. This place is huge. And there's style that and taste and change of taste that affects the museum world. And sometimes the building tends to dominate the art, and they were doing a lot of curvy, spirally things. The Meyer, is the Meyer one that's the circular one here at the one where you go up the circular staircase at Des Moines?
Oh, I'm not sure. I don't.
Yeah. So the building a little bit competes with the art in that wing.
Yeah.
It's an art form in itself, the building of art museums.
Yeah. Well, Meyer, of course, did the new Getty Center in.
That's right. Meyer did the
LA, and that's
Getty
a vast
that's right.
compendium of architectural
we
styles.
We could get into a whole show of discussing art museums, but Donna would have to go to the research computer to really make that a good show. That is a possibility for a show, is
that
the whole
be,
world of art gallery.
And well, and then there's the old art museums like the Louvre, where you have like gigantic rooms with enormous paintings from the Romantic era of, you know, these battle scenes by Delacroix, or, you know, romantic, hefty, fleshy chair, you know, people by Boucher or what, all of the older artists. Or you go to Rome and see wall size, gorgeous, luminous paintings by Raphael, and the Sistine Chapel ceiling, which are all amazing large works that, for me, when I went there, because I had seen pictures of all of these paintings in books, I thought I kind of had an idea of what it was going to feel like when I saw them, and it would just be like a little bit more interesting, not realizing the absolute mysterious power that these large works emit that you can't possibly acquire from seeing a picture in a book or seeing something in a film about it. The Sistine Chapel ceiling completely took me by surprise, and and we had to wait in line for probably 5 hours, you know, to get in the hot sun to get in to see it, and it was absolutely worth every minute of those 5 hours. And just, and you were supposed to be fairly silent in that room, and it's jam-packed with people, and everybody's craning their necks to look up and see it. And it's impossible for the people to stay quiet.
Yeah.
Because it's like ocean waves, you know. Somebody will make an announcement, we need to keep our voices down and keep quiet. And then, so the voices will go down a little bit, and then you'll hear it ebbing, because it's the impact of these images is just so great. So all through the ages, large works have cast a spell on people.
Yeah. I'd love to see the cleaned ceiling. I've only seen the old dark ceiling, but that was pretty astonishing in its own right. I think we should take over with their blessing, the Hy-Vee supermarket building. When they move, they're building a new building. And that would make an adequate space to get started with a permanent collection with large works and small works and multimedia works.
Okay, well, we'll get somebody to investigate.
Yeah, we should talk to Hy-Vee and ask them to give us the building and of course, donate the maintenance and utilities.
And one end of it could be an ice skating rink.
Well, yes, we could do a sculptural.
And we could have a mini mall.
I was thinking that we could actually fill it with art.
Well, it could be an artistic ice skating rink.
Yeah, it could be a fun for the whole family art gallery. Pinball machines and roller derbies.
All right, well, we'll look into all of this. I think we need to emphasize here in response to your statement that you don't know what fine art is until you experience it in the flesh.
Yes.
One of the problems with art education today is that people learn art history from art books and maybe slides, and they don't have a clue of what the presence of an original work of art is all about.
Yeah.
Nor do they have any idea of the amount of information that's in the original work, because the photograph and reproduction that's in the book, or the slide that's flashed up for a few minutes during your art history class, is just a very limited surface level of what's available to you in terms of visual information. And we should all take pilgrimages to the various museums of the world as we can to see these great works of art. And no one is prepared from a small book illustration to, as you said, to appreciate the grandeur of some of these 9 and 10 foot size paintings that were painted by the old masters.
20 and 30 foot
ones. And to imagine how they diligently worked at those things from dawn till dusk for years to create these masterpieces is almost mind-boggling, not to mention the Sistine Ceiling. That's like off the board.
Yeah. Well, you were mentioning Giotto last week, and you know, the frescoes that he did are, to me, as remarkable as the Sistine Chapel ceiling, because they go all the way up a wall in these cathedrals, and he had to paint them right there on site. They weren't some like a canvas that he could work on at home and transport there. And the whole technique of fresco painting, where it had to be, you know, just the right amount of wetness and dryness in the plaster, you know, that he was painting on. And when you see these frescoes, the luminous element, the light projecting from the cold plaster, is just absolutely remarkable. And I think any large work, well, any work of art whatsoever, no matter what its size, gives you something that's more mysterious than you can possibly define and describe. I've tried to write in a journal when I was going through art museums my impressions of the works, and after a while I just had to stop doing that, because I realized that there was something happening by my interaction with these works of art that was beyond the intellect, and possibly even beyond emotions. It was something, the artists really tap into something bigger than themselves, I think, for sure, and transmit something from the work that's bigger than ourselves as viewers, and that's part of the almost religious experience that we have when we see these great works of art.
And it has to be taken in as a whole, in its own terms, which mostly means visual, although there are symbolic elements. So it's not something, some combination of words and a small picture in a book is just like pointing you in the direction of this thing. But to stand in front of it and receive the whole message that he clicked with as he was standing in front of it and creating it, there was a point at which he said, yes, it's in there. And he wants you to stand in front of it and to open yourself to receive his gift.
And even just from a purely, you know, mechanical standpoint, there are no printer's inks that can reproduce the colors that an oil painter, you know, spends a lifetime tweaking and perfecting and exploring and mixing. And similarly, there's no way you can reproduce the scale of something on a page or even on a slideshow. There's just no way that you're actually seeing the thing. And we're so used to living in a world of reproductions that, you know, we see in kind of a spectrum that TV is capable of doing, and a spectrum that, you know, inkjet printers are capable of doing. And we lose sight of the fact that, you know, everything you find in a magazine or even a super high quality printed, you know, coffee table book is printed in three colors plus black. And they're actually three rather revolting colors if you look at them by themselves. So very wan, washed out yellow, and a really kind of sickly magenta, and a, you know, a powder blue kind of cyan. And you know, the eye is tricked into seeing a spectrum, but it's not the spectrum that we see in the real world, and it's not the spectrum that these great artists have devoted decades to, you know, perceiving and working with.
Yeah, that's something people don't realize too when they go and see works of art, how much, you know, you look at an oil painting and they think of going to Dick Blick's or somewhere and getting some tubes of oil paint and mixing it with some turpentine or, you know, mm-hmm. and applying it to the canvas. And one time I bought a book called The Secrets of the Great Oil Painters or something like that, and I was absolutely floored by all of the things that they did to basic oil paints. Sometimes they made their own paint, but all of the things they added to it and the ways they tweaked it and the ways they applied it, they were hundreds and hundreds of times more complex and experimental.
Yeah.
Than anything I had ever, because I was thinking, oh, I could try some of these. I get this book so I could try some of these things. Yeah. And
well, I'd like to see that book.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting.
Well, it was like so complex, it just overwhelmed me.
Well, most of the formulas of the old masters are lost. We don't even know what they mm-hmm. did, but it was that. Yeah. Yeah. They got into that fine degree of distinctions between elements that went into their mediums. Mm-hmm.
I just recently saw Beowulf, which is the current, you know, this week's state of the art in digital animation. And the faces, of which, of course, we see in a very special way, are very realistic. But, you know, the emphasis is on the istic, not the real. Mm-hmm. and, of course, the motion underneath the skin is much less well managed. But there's a phenomenon in computer graphics surface rendering called subsurface scattering, which is the effect of when you're looking at alabaster or jade or onyx or human skin, the light penetrates the skin and then is bounces out of the skin, not just off of the skin. So when you're defining the algorithms that describe how the imaginary light bounces off this imaginary skin, it's very complicated, and it doesn't look at all realistic until you accommodate subsurface scattering. And when you look at the, you know, some of the even fairly simple oil painting techniques involving, you know, egg oil emulsions and multiple layers and things, that's exactly what they're doing. They're building depth into the color so that colors are being filtered by outer layers and bouncing off of lower layers and getting filtered some more on the way back mm-hmm. out. And you get luminescences and you know, subtle interactions of color that are not even possible simply with paint. It's only with layers of paint and mm-hmm. layers of special kinds of paint and mm-hmm. controlling the translucency of the medium and things like that, and it's really excruciatingly subtle and totally unreproducible.
Right, and all you have to do is go to the museum and scan, say, a Renaissance room or something, and you'll just feel the difference between the great masters mm-hmm. and the other artists of the period, mm-hmm. because the skin quality usually has this luminescence in the great mm-hmm. masters. Rubens, for instance, is an example.
Yeah.
Well, the others will feel kind of dead, and then you'll look at, and then you can come back and you can look at the work of amateur artists and student artists and people that are just developing their techniques, and you can see the difference between a master and others.
Yeah,
because there's a one-dimensional quality to the paintings,
right,
that the masters don't have, because they have developed dense layering of multi-dimensional elements, actually, to create these masterworks. There's a reason why paintings have been revered and are held with great esteem.
Well, mastery of the technique to the point where you can paint a painting that looks right is really just one stage. It's like a pianist who has developed his skill to the point where he can play a piece by Chopin without making any mistakes. And that's great. And you hear it and you think, that's wonderful. sounded nice. And then you hear a real master of piano playing the same piece, and you discover that there are things going on, variables that he can play with, dimensions of expression that the master pianist can use while playing all the correct notes without making any mistakes. So his goal is no longer getting through it without tripping. He's not even thinking about getting through it. His attention is on many other layers of subtlety in the presentation of those notes, and thinking about the loudness of each individual note in each individual chord, and creating little horizontal arrangements of loudness that you can't even contemplate doing if you're still thinking about how to get all the notes right without hitting the wrong one.
So I would say, as a teacher, and as someone who feels responsible for raising the level of art in the region, that an artist could do no better for himself than to travel and to look at all the masterworks he can possibly look at, because those are your best teachers. So in the last 20 seconds, I will mention that the large work show that we were discussing will continue at Icon Gallery, 58 North Main Street, in Fairfield until January 19th.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.